Morning on June 24th, 2008, and we are in the State Capitol Building. My name is Commissioner Steve Kolbeck, and with me is Commissioner Dusty Johnson. But first of all, we will go to the phone lines and check who is on the phone lines with us. Bruce Gerhardsen?
Yeah, Bruce Gerhardsen from Otter Tail.
Okay, Dan Wall from East River.
Yes, correct.
Christine McDermott with Long Lines.
Yes.
Robin Norton with Consultant IC Solutions.
Hello, good morning. This is Robin.
Cindy Grossbrenner.
Here, sir.
Jerry Eisenhower with West River Co-op.
Yes, Commissioner.
John Canis and Catherine Marshall with Capital Telephone.
They are not present. I'm their local counsel, Ron Parsons, and I'm present.
Okay. And Chris Madsen with Quest.
Good morning, Mr. Commissioner. I'm here.
All right. Anyone else on the phone lines that I did not mention your name? All right. Hearing none, we'll start out with the first thing on our agenda, status report on consumer utility inquiries by Ms. Deb Gregg.
Thank you, Commissioner Kolbeck. The commission has received a total of 82 contacts since the last report was prepared for the June 10th, 2008 commission meeting. 18 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 13 of the contacts involved electrical services, 11 contacts involved natural gas service, 6 contacts involved cell phone service, 18 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, and 16 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 1,065 of the 1,116 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved, and 2,300 of the 2,337 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gregg. Any comments?
Not on this side, of Mr. Chairman, but maybe we can make it clear to those present that given the heat, we won't be offended if they shed a jacket.
Okay. It is a little warm up here this morning, so we are not in suit and tie attire if you start to boil in the back there. All right. The first thing we have on our agenda is a complaint, CT08-002. In the matter of complaint filed by Mr. Roger Hall of Rapid City, South Dakota, against Quest Corporation regarding the cost of telephone line extensions. On May 5th, 2008, Quest Corporation filed a response and a motion to dismiss the complaint. Today before the commission is, shall the commission dismiss the complaint and close the docket. Moving party is Quest. We'll hear from them first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Johnson, my name is George Thompson. I'd like to introduce myself formally to the commission and the staff. I'll be replacing Jason Topp as the in-house attorney representing Quest in South Dakota for some period of time going forward. So I'm happy to be here and privileged to appear in a historic building in old school style without any air conditioning. With regard to the matter at hand, Quest believes that Mr. Hall seems to fundamentally disagree with the proposition that someone who is a developer, which he is, must comply with Section 4.7 of Quest's Exchange and Network Services Catalog. The company has given Mr. Hall three options for service, ranging from a high quote of $5,125, a mid-range option of $4,972, and a splicing-only option of $2,425. Mr. Hall, as I understand it, has refused all three options. So this is not a case of the company denying service or refusing to provide service. These options are available to Mr. Hall at any time that he chooses to compensate the company for our materials and labor. Mr. Hall also seems to be slightly misunderstanding the posture that he takes individually. If these were individually deeded lots, which Mr. Hall had sold to new individual owners, obviously different rules would apply. But in this case, Mr. Hall remains the owner and the landlord, and therefore Section 4.7 of the Quest Catalog applies to his case. Given that the catalog language in this case is clear and that Mr. Hall refuses to pay any charges for any of the three options provided, Quest asks the commission to dismiss the complaint on the grounds listed by Quest in our answer and motion to dismiss. I've this morning been served with Mr. Hall's response to our motion to dismiss, and understand that he has some issue with the characterization of the motion as a motion to dismiss versus perhaps a motion for summary judgment. Frankly, we believe that it's certainly within the Commission's discretion to convert the motion to dismiss into a motion for summary judgment if they so choose, and we'd be happy to treat the complaint in that manner if it so pleases the Commission. With that, we have nothing else to say unless Mr. Hall is going to appear and get his case, in which case we'd like to have the opportunity for a short response.
All right. Thank you. Secondly, Mr. Hall, would you like to come up and speak?
Good morning, commissioners, everybody else present. I'm a little nervous here. I'm not an attorney. I'm not used to speaking to this type of thing. Thank you for hearing me this morning. Like I say, I come before you. I'm not an attorney. I am a little nervous, so I apologize.
Yeah, neither am I.
Oh, yeah. I'm not used to speaking to people.
All right.
You're already doing a better job than Commissioner Colbeck does. So. No, I'm kidding. He's phenomenal.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, and I appreciate you guys hearing me. I think fundamentally this needs to go to a hearing so the evidence can be heard under 12b-5 and the Universal Service of the Federal Telecom Act. Just a little background, and then I'll address the points that they come up with their motion to dismiss. My wife and I are 3 years into purchasing this property from my parents in Hill City. It's a business, and we're doing it in our contractor deed, so we're on a very low budget, you know, trying to survive type of mode. We provide low-income housing for 23 families right now in Hill City. That's the nature of a trailer court. In April of 2007, that's 14 months ago, I contacted Quest as a courtesy to notify them that I would open the trenches for them to install their lines to 4 new sites. I might note that since then I've gone on and we're building 5 more as we speak, of which 3 have already got commitments to be filled by the end of the month. That's Monday. Finally, after several months we are here. I don't completely understand the process, but it seems like Quest is trying to extend the process by filing this motion to dismiss instead of going straight to a hearing or a decision. I view the motion as kind of simple legal manipulating. I do believe that most people in my position right now would drop the complaint, and I don't intend to do that at this point. This complaint needs to be heard at a hearing so all the facts can get out. So let's address the motion to dismiss. First, what Mr. Thompson said. I'm not a developer, okay? In my mind, a developer is somebody that buys land as a speculator and goes in and subdivides it and improves it by building home sites. I'm not doing that. I'm taking an existing business, a trailer court that was in existence for over 17 years, and expanding, okay? So I just want to make sure I'm clear on that. First point, Quest states that Mr. Hall merely alleges that Quest has offered service, that Quest has offered a service consistent with its catalogs and tariffs. Well, I did not allege their service was inconsistent with their catalog. I'm not sure what their catalog says. I'm not aware of that. It wasn't explained to me very well by their engineer. He did a poor job at best. He also did a very poor job of presentation, and I know in your package you have a copy of what he presented me with his pencil line scribbles and stuff like that. I do work in the construction industry. I would not consider that a quote, so to speak. Okay, it was unclear on who was providing what, when it was work was going to be done, and the cost thereof. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Second point, Mr. Hall alleges that the telephone company is responsible for the lines with box on the house. He cites no authority for that proposition. Quest has used terms like MPOP, minimum point of presence, and campus environment. As a result, I've done a lot of research and reading into the South Dakota administrative rules regarding telephone service. I could not find any administrative rules where mobile home courts are defined as a campus environment. I'm dealing with a mobile home court. They may be classified this way in the tariff. Like I said, once again, I'm not familiar with the tariff. I think there may be a gray area between the administrative rules, the law, and the tariff agreement with Quest. Quest definition from their website of a campus environment is on a campus, industrial park, or multi-building apartment or business complex. The MPOP is normally the first building where a company network services are terminated. I do not have a first building. I have a mobile home court. The first building would be the first residence. As is commonly known, telephone company is responsible for the lines of the box on the house. They say that I state no category for that. Anybody got a Quest phone book? We built on page 27, and it pretty clearly defines it in there. So it is fairly common knowledge. Any wiring inside the house is the responsibility of the homeowner. I think we all know that. We all have telephone service. We've had to sign the wire agreement inside the house. Anything outside the house is theirs. As mobile homes are defined households is defined by the South Dakota Administrative Rules and by Quest definition becoming a single family dwelling where the service interface is located on the exterior wall of a residential structure. This point is known as the MPOP. Just to define MPOP a little bit so we're all on the same page. This is the first location where a dial tone is available in the customer's building. Once again, we come back to the first building on the property. In most residence and small business situations, the MPOP and first network interface are in the same spot. The MPOP and network interface are separate. Most tariffs require that the network interface be no more than 12 inches from the MPOP. So this is defining a point where they have to provide service. House cable and inside wiring in each unit belong to the building, not Quest. Therefore, the landlord and building owner owns the cable and all the wire past the MPOP in each building. And all cable between the buildings on the customer's property, and if they request work on this cable wire, Quest will bill them for the work. That's inside the residence, inside the MPOP or the small box that we all have on the outside of our houses. It defines MPOP locations for several different places. Single residential dwellings. The service interface point is located on the exterior wall of a residential structure. Once again, we're on individual residences. Single business locations on the exterior wall of the business structure. Once again, I don't have a business structure. Condominiums on the outside of the building. Multi-tenant buildings on the outside of the building. And it goes on. Campus arrangement. Usually first building where the company services are provided. I think it is important to define how the state defines some things. And under the codified law 2010-0503, terms defined in SDSCL 49-31-1, once again, I'm not an attorney, have the same meaning in chapters, and it goes on to list several. Applicant, anyone who is applying for telecommunications service. I am not applying for service. I have had two residents apply for service, and they've both been denied service or offered to get service for the cost of the $5,000 that Mr. Thompson mentioned earlier. A household, a family or group of people living together in a dwelling. I think we would all agree that a mobile home is a dwelling. A subscriber, one who is currently receiving telecommunications service. I'm not the applicant, I'm not the household, I'm not the subscriber. I do not pay the bill. He quoted section 4.3 a little bit ago, a company, and it says, where a company extends its facilities on public highways or on property to furnish main station service. And it goes on to define several things. It talks about 400 feet at no charge, okay? Customer will begin at the point paying for the point 400 feet. It's $1.25 a foot right in their agreement. That was not the offer made to me. One of the things I should point out is when I started this process 14 months ago, I had 17 trailers in the court. They are currently serving the 17 trailers. The drops from their line along the back of my property to the trailer is 20 feet. That's how long their line is. It's not very long. It's an easy drop. And in fact, for several years, Quest line was not mounted on Black Hills Power poles, who's run behind my property. It was actually strung down the fence line. So it's just hanging down my barbed wire fence. It was quite interesting to see how it worked. So the new homes, now remember I said they're only 20 feet. The new homes are only 80 feet from the existing homes. They're already there. I mean, we have new homes 80 feet away. So enough on that. We'll move on. We got other things to do today. Furthermore, the catalog provides where the facility is required to provide a requested service not available in the opinion of the company. The cost of provision service to a customer does not constitute a prudent investment. We're going to come back to prudent investment. The customer may be required to pay construction charges and several other, stuff like that. The customer, we're coming back to the customer. I'm not the customer. These charges and conditions may be in additional rates. Back to prudent investment. That's an interesting concept because I was never provided by the engineer or by Quest what their return on investment would be. First thing is, in Hill City, Quest is a monopoly. There is no other phone service. Absolutely no other phone service. This is why I think Telecom's Universal Service Act comes into play. You know, they're required by that to provide service. If I had an option to go to Mid-Continent or go to somebody else, I'd be glad to do it. But I have no option at this point. Prudent investment. Just a little quick math here. Average billing, $50 a month for a telephone bill. Who pays $50 a month for a telephone bill? Not very many of us. I know several people have internet, have cable, have telephone. So it's typically more than that. Let's just use $50. And let's say, you know, all the trailers in there probably have subscribed. They don't have a choice. So we do that, 17 existing mobile homes, 9 new mobile homes, and I'm adding more in the next few years. So 28 homes that I will now have in place by the end of the month times $50 a month is $1,400 a month income to Quest. Okay, multiply that out per year, $16,800 per year. If they invest $5,000 in their network, they return $16,000 in 1 year. That seems like a pretty prudent investment. I'd love to find that stock market fund. This does not, you know, and I'm not accounting for internet, cable TV, and all that, which the charges are obviously higher. I'm not accounting for long distance. If I just look at the news sites, now we heard earlier $5,100 to put this line in. If we just look at the news sites, 9 news sites that I put in last year and this year at $50 a month, that's $450 times 12 months, $5,400. 1 year return on their investment. I also think they should relook this prudent investment concept. You know, if it costs them $5,000 to put in service and they're going to get a $5,400 return in the first year, that's a pretty good return. I won't even talk about the cost of the people sitting behind me this morning, because I'm wagering that there's about $9,000 sitting behind me today. Prudent? I don't think so. Let's go into this other statement. Mr. Thompson said he's offered me service 3 provisions consistent with their catalog, 5125, 4972, 2425. Make sure you're clear on this. The $5,125 was if I provided the trench, which I was willing to do. Option 1 was for a conduit. Option 2 was for a trench. And that's only $157 different, you know. It doesn't make sense because we're going 400 feet. That's a pretty small savings for that kind of money. So something's inconsistent right there. If I pay for everything, they still had a $2,400 charge for splicing back into town. We'll talk about back into town in a minute. I have not turned these options down. I did not accept these options. I never got a formal proposal from Quest. I never received something in writing with a name or phone number I could call back. All I had was, once again, the scribbles on the paper, which you guys have in front of you. I always kind of felt the proposal was a tentative thing and we were going to fine-tune it. I always thought we could come to an agreement. Even talking to Colleen and Dan, I always felt that we could come to an agreement. That's why this took so long. And we'll talk about that a little bit, too. I got about 4 more items and I'm done. I promise. Quest provides service to mobile home parks where lots are individually owned pursuant to Section 4.4. Even if that did apply, the developer would be responsible for construction costs pursuant to 4.7. From what I know, most mobile home parks, and I'll say most because I didn't check every mobile home park in the state of South Dakota, are not legally platted into individual lots. Okay? This section of the tariff appears to be an attempt by Quest to classify individual homes in a campus environment. If this were a case, every mobile home court in South Dakota would be its own little telephone company. And I don't think any of us want that. That would be a gigantic headache. And there would be large switch boxes. Every time you pull into the trailer court, it would be a little building for a telephone company. We can't afford that, and I don't want to maintain it. Furthermore, if each lot is platted, it no longer falls under the definition of a mobile home court. It would then become a subdivision and legally assigned street names by the city or governing body, and street addresses. So you wouldn't see, you know, 4244 East Highway 44, lot number 12. You'd see, you know, Sioux Street 1232. I checked 12 mobile home courts in Pennington County. Okay, I didn't go outside of Pennington County. I just checked 12. Went and did the plat research and everything down at the courthouse. 12 of them. None of them. Not one was individually platted for individual trailers. Not one. So I think this may be an error in their tariff. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I think this is a place where there's a gray area between the law and the tariff. Quest states, Mr. Hall's final argument seems to be based on Quest General Investment and Network. Mr. Hall argues that Quest has failed to live up to its obligation to prudent management practice. The only evidence Mr. Hall cites In support of that position, Quest does not have the facilities in place to serve mobile home lots he intends to develop. Bear with me. This one gets a little long. It's a page long. So,
and we don't. We have the testimonies here.
This is in addition to that.
So in addition to that, okay.
This is all in addition to that. This is explaining that farther. I've taken all that stuff and kind of gleaned this out of it. But let me explain that. This is I've got 2 pages left. Okay, maybe 3. I'm an estimator, not a neglector. I work in construction. Once again. You know, they say I intend to, lots he intends to develop. I'm past the point of intending to develop. I have 9 lots right now, 4 of which I developed are in place, 5 more I'm building this year, 3 of them are committed. I'm sorry, Commissioner Kolbeck, but I'd like to say, address their complaint, as, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
I don't mean to cut you off.
So. Oh, no, that's fine. I just wanted, I thought you were speaking to a pre-filed testimony, and we have that copy of what was filed this morning. And
well, I've done research beyond that since I was coming to Pierre. So
okay.
This is...
Absolutely.
Christ, well, ask these days, I've got to make it worth it. Yes, sir.
Well, and Mr. Hall, you know, please continue. You're a layperson, a citizen. I mean, at least this commissioner's willing to provide you a great deal of latitude. You know, just so you know, normally we would only hear about a Quest motion to dismiss as opposed to the facts of the case. I mean, I think the argument you're trying to make, and I think you're doing a good job of it, is there are a lot of facts that may be in question here.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Well, and I do want to... I'll abbreviate, okay, in the interest of time, and I understand there's people on the phone listening, too. You know, the intent to develop, I've already said it, I've added more sites, okay? And I just want to stick to their points, and that's key here. I'm not asking Quest to build out their facility to manage every conceivable build-out. All I want is the ability of sites, this land is open, okay? There are 6 lots up Bishop Mountain Road behind me. Remember, the Quest line runs on 3 sides of my property. There are 6 lots up behind me that they are incapable of serving right now that somebody could develop at any time. But I am developing, and I am proceeding with a facility that was already in place. Okay? So, network investment prudent planning. When you're only a game of town and you have a monopoly in Quest, I believe it would be wise to ensure the system has capability and redundancy to handle moderate growth. I have been informed both by the area and state Quest engineers that there is only a single pair left in the line from the southeast corner of Hill City to the main switch. As I pointed out, there are numerous opportunities to grow in the south, so there's not much redundancy for most of Hill City. During my conversation with Quest, they continually referred to their system of upgrades back into town. I have a problem with that. If I'm back into town, that would imply I'm into town. I'm 3,000 feet from the switch, as I've shown you in the documents. So I'm still not confident in their knowledge or location of where I'm at. It seems to keep going. Like I say, in the interest of time, I'll skip a bunch of that. So, it is important for me to note that when I did finally meet with Quest up there, the engineer was unaware of how the existing 12 of the 17 existing trailers were getting service. He actually told me that, I said, well, how do those get service? He told me, if I want to know that, I'd have to find that out myself. I'm like, you're the engineer. So anyway, Quest states, if Quest were required to anticipate every new potential, they'd have to have facilities in place. There would be no need for sections 4.3 to 4.7. Prospective customers. In the law, it says they must provide facilities for prospective customers. That would clearly mandate that Quest has an obligation to provide the adequate facilities to support growth within an area. As I noted, summary events, cost of the system. When I asked Dan Kaiser for an interpretation of that, he told me very point blank that meant they had to be able to handle the customers they currently had. I was a little concerned on the word perspective, you know. But when they say they only have to handle the ones they have. So anyway. I'll go to the end. Quest is a monopoly. I have no choice. You know, it's not like I have options. I'm not the customer. I don't pay the bills. I don't see why I should fund Quest system improvements. It's taken a great deal of my time over the last 14 months to get to here. I don't have this kind of time. I work a full-time job, plus I'm running this business. Based on Rule 12b-5 and the Universal Service Mandate from the Federal Telecoms Commission, I'm requesting that this be moved to a hearing, and we can discuss this at length. I'm prepared to discuss this further today. You've obviously pointed out, Commissioner, it is not in my best interest or quest to return here to hear this further. You know, I never knew when I filed this simple complaint that I would get bogged down in such a legal process. You know, I'm just a citizen trying to make a living out there. I'd like to request a decision from Quest today, but it's my understanding that because of the motion dismissed, we must request this action be moved to a hearing so we can discuss it further. Thank you. I skipped the last three pages.
That's fine. And I didn't mean to cut you short.
That's fine.
We were going to...
But I was trying to address the points. So.
No problem. And thank you very much for your comments.
All right.
What we'll do is we'll give Quest a little bit of time to rebut, and then we'll go to staff for a few comments, and then open it up for commissioner questions. That's usually how we'll go about it.
Right.
Sure. We'll take staff first. So how about Harlan, Deb, or Ms. Semler?
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. I do understand Mr. Hall's frustration, and I understand how it gets real complicated when you start trying to read the law and tariff and comparing it all. And I feel for the frustration he had with the company. However, miscommunications with the company are not relevant to the legal discussion that we're having here today. I do, however, agree that there are a great number of facts at question. And staff looked specifically to Section 4 of the tariff, and, you know, the tariff is prima facie evidence of reasonable behavior if they did follow the tariff as outlined and as is available on the Internet, both on our website and on Quest. And we looked to Section 4, specifically 4.3, and where there is not adequate capacity in place, I see where the applicant must be charged the actual cost. And from some prior conversations we had with Quest, as I understand it, and I'll look to Quest to correct me if I am wrong, there is not adequate capacity, and some additional infrastructure would need to be built and put in place. And the tariff does indicate that the applicant should be charged for such costs. Very factual, and I understand today we're discussing a motion to dismiss. So with that being said, I would leave to the discretion of the commission whether we'll be proceeding with the motion to dismiss today or if it will be converted into a motion for summary judgment.
All right, thank you. Quest, would you like a moment to rebut?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, commissioners. All we'd like to do is place in the commission's hands, and also we have a copy for Mr. Hall, Section 4.7 of the tariff. And perhaps that'll make a little clearer what the duties and responsibilities of the company are vis-a-vis Mr. Hall's development. I would say yes, there have been quite a number of additional facts presented today, but I think one of the salient facts that we need to realize is despite Mr. Hall's protestations, he is a developer. He's developing a mobile home park, and I think it's very clear from what he said when he spoke to you that that's exactly what he intends to do. This argument is about whose responsibility it is to pay overhead to expand his mobile home park, and I think it's fairly clear in Section 4.7 of the tariff, which I'll provide to the commission right now, that it is Mr. Hall's responsibility. If you'll allow me to approach, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please.
With that, we have nothing further, Mr. Chairman. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. We'll move now to Mr. Hall. I'll give you a moment to rebut there, just in fairness.
One thing is, and it's not to rebut that, but to add a little bit to what Kara said, additional capacity, for me to pay for the additional capacity, at one point I asked the question, if I'm the last person to develop, and to make sure we're clear on this, there's been development to all sides of my property. If I'm the last person to develop, how come I have to pay the price to upgrade the system? You know, all these other people used up the capacity, but why am I the one stuck with the bill? You know, if we spread that bill over all those people that developed, all 20-some of them, it wouldn't be exorbitant. to increase the capacity. But by myself, it becomes exorbitant. And once again, you know, the developer comment, you know, we can go both ways on that. I deal with developers all the time. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Commissioner, questions? Commissioner Johnson.
You know, to Ms. Sendler or staff in general, I mean, are there some, I mean, I look at 400 feet free allowance, and there appears to be some dispute as to how far some things are or where that allowance would actually give up, and then a term like adequate capacity. Presuming that the commission were to only take action on the motion to dismiss as opposed to a conversion to a different motion, aren't those two instances where some factual determination needs to be reached by the commission, and wouldn't that preclude us granting a motion to dismiss?
I do agree, Commissioner. There are specific fact questions, those being the two major questions.
Sure.
I agree.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, a question for Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith, it seems to me that in the past you've described to me that under South Dakota law, certain notification provisions need to be taken before a tribunal like ours would convert a motion to dismiss to something else. Is that right?
That's correct. In terms of, I mean, I'll just tell you right now, if you think there are factual issues here, first of all, granting a motion to dismiss is not appropriate legally. It's just not. And it just sounds to me that there are. I mean, at a minimum, I mean, are we talking more than 400 feet here? Is there a capacity issue here? Now, Quest may believe there's absolutely no issue with respect to those things. The fact is, those are factual decisions, and those are not appropriately decided on a motion to dismiss. In terms of the procedure, there's a case, Richards v. Lenz, that lays out what you do when a court, and you're a court in this sense, in that we do follow the rules of civil procedure as a default when we don't have specific rules. Rule 56 and Richards v. Lenz basically provide a procedure for if Quest elects to, and again, you could just deny it today, and you can put the burden on Quest to come forward with a motion for summary judgment. That's another option. That's up to them then. You don't have to do that. If you do want us to proceed with it as a motion for summary judgment, then, and I'm not so sure that's really the best avenue here, and I'll tell you why, because if it begins with a motion for summary judgment, then those formalities that a party has to conform to when they make a motion for summary judgment, which is the statement of uncontested facts, facts about which there's no genuine issue, affidavits, supporting affidavits, which conclusively show a right to relief. You know, so we sort of started out on the right footing, if you want to call it that. And I just don't know. That's a judgment question its legal counsel will have to make as to whether you believe you can meet the summary judgment standard. But I'm going to tell you, I've heard enough to where I don't think a motion to dismiss is appropriate. Granting it is appropriate.
And Mr. Smith, I don't have any intention of, you know, trying the moving party's case for them. I mean, I would think we deal with the motion in front of us. I just wanted to make it clear that it appears as though we wouldn't be able to convert a motion to dismiss to a motion to summary judgment and take any action today.
You may not. If you do that, it's a minimum. You have to give a minimum. We have to do a formal notice, serve it, and the hearing on the motion for summary judgment has to be at least 10 days after that.
Thanks very much.
All right. Well, I have a great amount of questions myself. Hearing no other discussion, I'm going to motion in C208-002 that the commission deny the motion to dismiss and close the docket. Discussion.
If I might, we don't want to close the docket because it grant the motion.
Yeah, we're just going to grant the motion, deny the motion to dismiss, and we will not close the motion, or close the docket. Discussion. Action. Commissioner Johnson.
I vote aye.
And Commissioner Kobach votes aye also. The next docket?
Commissioner Kolbeck, as long as it occurs to me, I mean, this is probably, I don't think we do it enough, but this is a great example where, you know, we got some paperwork this morning and it's already on the internet for everybody to take a look at. It's accessible to commissioners, and I'm sure we don't do enough to thank our administrative staff for making sure that we're able to run things smoothly. And we noticed it during TransCanada, and we probably don't do it outside of that docket enough to thank them for what they do. So, and I also want to make clear, I know you know I was kidding, but you're a very good public speaker, sir. So for those listening on the internet.
Especially when I hem and haw and say and oh and make the, we're not going to close that docket? Okay. No. Next, Ms. Kramer, did you, should we just proceed with the agenda as planned, or?
Yes, when we had discussed it earlier, I didn't know how many of those phone companies for those USF packets were going to be on the phone, and I didn't want to be tying up lines.
Oh, sure.
If we had people waiting, so okay. But it doesn't appear to be a problem.
I think we're okay on the lines. We'll just continue on with our docket or agenda as planned. In electric, we have EL08-013 in the matter of petition of Otter Tail Corporation doing business Otter Tail Power Company for approval of an extension of its test period. Otter Tail Power Company filed a petition for extension of their test period, and today shall the commission approve the petition for the extension. First of all, Otter Tail is the moving party, so we'll go to them. Otter Tail on the line. Bruce?
Yes, this is Bruce Gerritsen for Otter Tail, Associate General Counsel for Otter Tail Corporation. Thank you, commissioners. This is a relatively straightforward petition. Otter Tail is anticipating filing a rate case, a general rate case in South Dakota by November 1st of this year. The last time Otter Tail filed a rate case in South Dakota was in 1986. Our last, the order in that case came out in 1987, so it's been a number of years. And maybe just for a little background, just to tell you a little bit about Otter Tail, we serve about 130,000 total customers in three states, Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota, 91% of which are in North Dakota and Minnesota. Only about 9% of our 130,000 customers are in South Dakota. We have the request really is to be allowed to use a 2007 calendar year in our filing, which would be made by November 1st. Your regulation 2010-1344 says that with good cause shown, we can file using data that is earlier than 6 months prior to the filing using historic test year data. But we do need to make that good cause, to show that good cause, and that is the purpose for our filing and the purpose for this hearing this morning. A few things to point out. There is a great deal of accounting work that needs to be done in order to prepare a test year for rate case filing. And for Otter Tail, which has been particularly active, as you, I think, are well aware, in permitting for Big Stone 2 and in other regulatory activities such as a rate case that is currently pending in Minnesota, we have been very, very busy, I will say, but at the same time, we really cannot put off filing our rate case in South Dakota any longer. There's other reasons besides our busyness that I think justify and show good cause why using data that is earlier than 6 months prior to our November filing in this instance. Not the least of which is that there will be a great benefit, we think, if we can file our rate case in South Dakota using the same data as a filing we intend to make in North Dakota. That will prevent us from having to duplicate efforts in preparing test year data. We also think that the use of a calendar year is preferable to using what we call a split year. That is, if we were to file in November, using data that's no older than 6 months, it would require that we use a split year. That is sort of half of 2007 and half of 2008. And the benefit will not be just to the company. That will also, we believe, be a benefit to staff and interveners who should have an easier time verifying test your data, because we will have audited financials, published information, reports to SEC and other things, which can be used, like I say, to verify the test your data that we intend to use in our rate case. I guess, finally, there really should be no prejudice to ratepayers or interveners if we are to use a calendar year 2007 and make our filing by November. There is no reason to believe that in the period, in the year 2008, that our costs are going to go down. In fact, there's every reason to believe our costs are going to go up. Inflation alone, and as you're well aware, in certain fuels and things, we're seeing rather dramatic increases. And if by using a 2007 calendar year and making adjustments, I believe your rules allow for adjustments that are limited to 24 months following the end of the test year that's used in the test year filing, we will be able to, we will limit our the amount of the inflationary pressure that is going to influence our rate case filing quite a bit. So I don't think that there will be any prejudice, and in fact there may be some mitigation of the rate increase that we're going to anticipate in our rate filing. So for those reasons, and because there is some commission precedent for doing so, which I cite in my petition, we would request that the commission grant our request for authority to use a calendar year 2007 test period for our rate case that we would file on or before November 1st, 2008.
All right. Thank you. Next, we'll turn to staff. Mr. Jacobson?
Thank you, Chairman. With staff, really, we don't have any objection to using the calendar year 2007 test year. It has been done before. We did it. We approved it for a Mid-American rate case some years back. That's the only other time I think that this has come before the commission.
Okay. All right. Commissioner, questions?
For Otter Tail, is the timing of your filing before the North Dakota Commission, is that because of some provision in North Dakota law?
Actually, it's not. We have some more flexibility in North Dakota in that they allow the use of historic test year, known and measurable changes similar to yours, plus we could use forecast year. We've, however, found that the use of a historic test year is preferable in that state. And they do not have any restriction on how far back you can go. So it really is that it's our administrative preference, I think, to use the 2007, the most recent closed historic test year on a calendar basis.
Sure, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Yes, this is Commissioner Kovac. I had one question for you. Are you sure you want to file a rate case? No, I'm just giving you a bad time. The question I have is, why exactly in the calendar year, will that, if we did not change it, what exactly would be the hardship for you as Otter Tail Power?
Well, if we didn't use a calendar year and we're not allowed to file by November 1st or the time up until November 1st, we'd have to have, there'd be one of two consequences. One consequence would be we could file a split-year test year, and as I mentioned, that creates a significant amount of administrative burden both on us. We think it would also burden staff and interveners, as I mentioned in my presentation. The alternative would be to make a calendar year filing within 6 months, which I think we all but exhausted that possibility, and as I mentioned, with a very small regulatory staff, given the amount of regulatory activity we've had recently with Big Stone 2, Minnesota rate case, other regulatory proceedings, frankly, it just would not be feasible for us to use a calendar year. So probably the only alternative for us would be to try and file in the November time frame using a split year, which we don't think would benefit any party. Is that a fair answer to your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Any other questions from staff or commissioners? Hearing none, action.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the commission approve the petition made by Otterdale.
All right, discussion. Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Kovac votes aye also. The next item on the agenda, EL08-016, the matter of application of East River Electric Power Cooperative for a permit to construct 9.5 miles of 115 kV transmission line in Lincoln and Turner counties. On June 12, 2008, East River Electric Cooperative submitted an application for a construction permit, and today shall the commission assess a filing fee and deposit of $8,000. And how shall the commission proceed regarding the SDCL 4941B-15 landowner notice requirements? First of all, the moving party, East River. Mr. Hall?
Actually,
staff didn't.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
We have put that on the agenda. Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. As to the first question, pursuant to SDCL 4941B-12, East River is required to deposit a filing fee to cover the costs of investigating, reviewing, processing, and serving notice of the application. The minimum amount in this matter would be the $8,000, so that is what staff is asking for. And then as to the second question of landowner notice requirements, 4941B15 requires the owner of record of any land located within 1/2 mile of the proposed facility be notified. And I'm sure you recall in the last few dockets, what you've done is you've used the property tax list as the list of persons to give notice to. East River has submitted that list to staff, and so we have that. And so staff is recommending that that be the list that is used to give notice.
All right. And East River, any comments?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dan Wall. No comments.
Okay. Commissioner questions.
Mr. Kramer, this is the third or maybe fourth time the commission used this mechanism, maybe more. Those are the times I can remember. Have we had any complaints, or does it seem to be working well?
We've had no complaints that I know of. Ms. Semler's shaking her head. I don't believe Ms. Gregg's had any, so I think it's gone well.
Great. Thanks very much. And, of course, I mean, July 1, it becomes the law of this land anyway, so.
That's correct, yes.
All right. Thank you. We are in possession of the list, that's correct?
Yes, staff got that list a week, maybe 10 days ago, so we're ready to go if that's the approved method.
And that'll be done before July 1st, so?
Yes, that will be done. Well, we'll get it out as soon as possible, yeah.
Because that's when the burden shifts, correct, on July 1?
Correct.
Okay. Any other discussion?
I just maybe note one thing that you might want to include in your motion. In the past, adoptions of this procedure, the commission has specified that we include in there a statement to the effect that the tax recipient, it's his obligation to provide notice to any co-owners.
Okay. All right, any other discussion? Hearing none, I'll motion in EL08-016 that the commission assess the filing fee and deposit of $8,000. We'll vote on that motion. All right. Discussion? None. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
And Commissioner Kovac votes aye on that also. And in addition, I'll motion that the commission proceed as according to staff's recommendations of using the county assessment list and to include a statement as noted by staff of co-owners. Discussion? All right, action. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
And Commissioner Kovac votes aye on that also. In our next docket, pipeline safety, PS08-002, in the matter of filing by Northwestern Corporation doing business as Northwestern Energy for approval of a waiver of 49 CFR sections 192.285A and 2 and 192.285C. On April 21st, 2008, Northwestern Corporation requested a waiver of Part 192.285C, and today shall the Commission approve the waiver. Moving party is Northwestern. so we'll hear from them first. Anyone from Northwestern on the line? Or in the room? I don't see anyone signed in or on the line, so I guess we'll go to staff.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Kara Semler for staff. On April 21st, 2008, Northwestern Corporation, doing business as Northwestern Energy, filed a request for waiver of 49 CFR 192.285 Section C. This regulation requires that plastic pipe joiners be requalified during any 12-month period where they either do not make any joints or where three joints or 3% of the joints they make are unacceptable. The permanent waiver requested states all joiners would be requalified at least each calendar year, but at intervals not exceeding 15 months. In addition, if one joint made is unacceptable, that joiner must requalify under the procedure as an initial qualification. This change allows for qualification to occur during the off-construction season, thereby eliminating a hardship for the applicant. This commission did approve a nearly identical waiver in January of 08 for a different natural gas pipeline distribution company. Staff does recommend approval of the waiver, and if approved, recommends forwarding the order to PHMSA. Also of note, there is a resolution pending by the National Association of Pipeline Safety Representatives to PHMSA recommending a permanent rule change regarding this issue, a similar type of waiver.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Simler. Any other staff comments? If not, commissioner comments? Questions?
Do we know, Ms. Simler, staff, if other states have provided similar waivers?
They have. I don't think I have a list of them with me, but that was part of the research I know that Nathan Solomon, other staff member, did, and other states have, yes, granted such a waiver.
Thanks very much.
And this is Commissioner Kovac. I just have one. It's been 5 months since we actually approved the other. Has there been any complaints or any filings concerning that?
No. And I should have brought this with, but I do believe PHMSA ultimately could reverse a commission decision such as this. It has to go to them for approval, and I think that PHMSA did sign off on the previous one as well. So. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Commission action?
I move the commission approve the waiver. I guess that's my motion.
All right. Discussion? Hearing none. Action? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kovac votes aye also.
I had discussion, but it looked like it wasn't. The vote wasn't very close, so I don't need to display any votes. Thanks.
The next one in telecommunications. In the matter TC06-184, in the matter of filing by Long Lines Wireless, LLC, for designation of an eligible telecommunications carrier on October 30th, 2006, Long Lines Wireless, LLC, filed for a petition for designation of an eligible telecommunications carrier. Today, shall the commission designate Long Lines Wireless, LLC, as an eligible telecommunications carrier? This has come before us before. It's taken some time. We are without Commissioner Hansen today. I would like to defer this action today. Is there any objections from Long Lines?
Oh, as you had said, this has been before the commission for quite some time. We would prefer if it could be done today.
Okay. You realize that there's only two commissioners present.
Do the commissioners have objections to the filing? Or do you think there's any issues with granting the petition?
Well, that I don't know, but I would rather have a full commission vote on this since it has been before us before.
This is Commissioner Johnson, and Commissioner Kolbeck, I'd agree with your comments. I just think as we dive further and further into these ETC issues, this may be a quasi-judicial docket, but boy, we really are setting some policy here, writing decisions and orders that are sort of setting at least an informal precedence in how this commission will view future ETC filings. I would really hesitate to render a decision without Chairman Hansen here to at least provide his input.
Okay.
Yes. Anything from staff? No. I believe that's the correct way to handle this. I know that with the interim cap in place and ETC filings and competitive LECs, I would rather we had a full commission before we voted on this. So we will defer this item until a future date.
Will that future date be at the next hearing in 2 weeks?
I would hope so.
And Ms. McDermott, I mean, we, I do think certainly the commissioners had either Commissioner Kubek or I known that we were going to, I didn't know he was going to make that motion. I frankly was interested in making the motion myself. One thing we should have done that frankly would have been kinder to you is let you know that in Commissioner Hansen's absence we wouldn't feel comfortable taking this item up. So my apologies for not giving you advance notice.
That's fine.
Yes, we actually, there was a mix-up. As far as I'm concerned, too, also. I knew I was going to be running the agenda today, and I it was a last-minute deal that I knew that we only had, we were down one commissioner, so my apologies also. And I would hope that that issue would come up on the next docket. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. In the next item, TC07-090, in the matter of application of Inmate Calling Solutions, LLC, doing business as IC Solutions for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services in South Dakota. IC Solutions intends to provide automatic collect calling services to inmates of correctional institutions throughout the state. Today shall the Commission accept the letter of credit and grant a certificate of authority to Inmate Calling Solution, LLC, doing business as IC Solutions. So the moving party is?
Yes, Commissioner Kubek. I can start out this.
Okay.
This is Dave Jacobson and Commission staff. This is an application by Inmate Calling Solutions for a certificate of authority to provide alternative operator services in South Dakota. The applicant requests authority to provide services to both inmates at correctional facilities and to regular customers at other various locations. Applicant is requesting a waiver of number 1 ARSB 2010-2402, which is providing of financial statements, and has submitted an irrevocable letter of credit in the amount of $25,000. The applicant, with regard to the provision of service to inmates at correctional facilities only, the applicant has requested a waiver of ARSD 2010-24055, which is prohibition of call blocking, 2010-24056, which is the transfer of 911 calls, and the first sentence of 2010-24511, which requires compliance with the Telephone Operator Consumer Services Improvement Act of 1990, 47 U.S.C., subsection 226, in order to offer the limited controlled type of service necessary at correctional facilities. We would recommend approval of the COA and the waivers with respect to the type of service being offered, and also a representative of the company is on the telephone.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Robin Norton, would you like to come in?
I'm here just to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner, questions? I just have one. Irrevocable line of credit, is that going to be in our possession then?
Yes, it's in our possession. The original is in our possession, and you know, it's a similar, it's got attributes that are similar to mine. The only, I guess the big difference is that it's really more like having cash in your file. This one is cancelable, but so are all the bonds we get for this purpose. So to me, it's as good a security, if not better, than the bonds we get.
Okay. And, Mr. Jacobson, could you go over call blocking and what were the other two?
Yes, the waivers, the first waiver, which is applicable both to inmate alternative operator service and just general alternative operator service, is the requirement for financial statements. That's the first waiver. With respect to providing services at correctional facilities only, the 2010-24055, which is the prohibition on call blocking, 2010-24056, transfer of 911 calls.
Oh.
And 2010-24011, just the first sentence of that, which requires compliance with the federal act, which is necessary in order to provide services under controlled circumstances at correctional facilities.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? I'll move in TC07-090 that the commission accept the $25,000 line of credit and grant a COA to Inmate Calling Solutions, LLC, doing business as IC Solutions, according to staff's recommendations. Discussion?
Maybe not about this docket, but in a more general sense. I mean, should our rules be altered at some point in the future to allow a letter of credit in lieu of bond?
Well, they do now. Our rule provides for a bond or other security that the commission finds acceptable.
Then why the first half of this question had come before us? It seems that when we have a bond, we don't normally make a proactive motion to accept the bond. Is that right?
I think mainly, maybe, no, not necessarily. We usually, and usually the commission on, in terms of approval of particular bond language, usually that's pretty much delegated to staff to
sure.
review those and make sure that the condition. I think the only reason, and I had nothing to, I was in Oklahoma all last week, so I don't know how the questions get on here, but, in terms of letter of credit language, since we haven't had them as a practice, I think part of it in this case was just coming up with a form that we found acceptable. And we actually did that, Ms. Norton, quite some time ago, but then, the applicant, had a change of banks in the interim, and so, We had a backup a couple of weeks here.
Thanks,
Mr. Commissioner. The reason the question was put on there is strictly for to expose that this was somewhat of a precedent-setting situation, and in the future that language would not be necessary. We just wanted to make it real transparent and clear that this was not. It was something new that hadn't been before the commissioners before, so you would notice that.
I might also add, because the rule does explicitly, it explicitly references bond and indicates that that's acceptable, it does say, or other security as approved by the commission. And so, in order to deviate from a bond, I do think you've at least got to recognize the fact that you're accepting security other than which our rule explicitly allows.
So then, I guess I'll go back to my original question, which is, should we alter the wording of that rule to make it clear that a letter of credit is de facto acceptable, I mean, or default is...
I don't think it would be a bad idea, and since Relaine does all the work on rulemakings, I think it's a great idea.
Commissioner, I would add one thing, too, is that with my limited knowledge on this subject matter, with talking to the consultant, there are also different rules for inmate in correctional facilities as opposed to a general AOS certificate, and both federally and in a lot of state jurisdictions I just became aware of, that that way, in this case, you have separate waivers that apply only to correctional facilities and certain waivers that apply overall to all AOS activities, and in certain jurisdictions, they've separated that into two distinct groups, so...
Thanks very much.
Any other discussion? All right. Seeing none, Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Kovac votes aye on that also. Okay, on the next one, TC08-005, in the matter of a complaint filed by Orbitcom Incorporated against Global Crossing Communications Incorporated regarding switch access services. On June 2nd, 2008, Global Crossing filed a reply in support of the motion to dismiss, and today Shall the commission dismiss the complaint and close the docket? The moving party, I believe, is Global Crossing. So, Mr. Van Kamp?
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Colbeck. I'm Bill Van Kamp. I'm in State Council for Global Crossing Telecommunications, Inc. A brief background, which I think is telling in this motion to dismiss. The commission may recall in TC07079 in June of 2007, a pro se filing was filed by Orbitcom requesting recovery of what was claimed to be $320,000 of inter and intrastate access charges. On July 27th, 2007, a representative of Orbitcom filed with this commission a letter requesting that the docket be closed as they received all the intrastate access charges they claimed to do at that time. That led about to the filing of 07079. So 07079 goes away. February 4th, 2008, we received an additional filing from Orbitcom with an amount, I think, in the $280,000 range. Interesting, in that motion, they do go to length to state, again, that they dismissed 07079 because the interstate access charges were paid through June of 07. Of note, they did file, and I'll go through this at length, an exhibit with their filing marked as Exhibit A, which purports to be the amounts that were past due totaling $283,000. February 22nd, Global Crossing files a motion to dismiss with about a ream and a half of paper that tied out the billings from their Exhibit A, showing that we had paid, at least according to the billings, we had received all the intrastate access charges. Now, certainly this commission is not in a position to entertain a motion for recovery of interstate access charges, even though it certainly, and I won't belabor the point, it was in both of Orbitcom's filings that they wanted the commission to help us push that issue. May 16th, we get reply affidavits, Global Crossing does, from Orbitcom, stating that in June of 07, they discovered that there was a billing error on the bills that were sent for access charges to Global Crossing. That billing error, according to the affidavits of May 16th, goes back to 2004. Whether or not that's strictly a billing error for Global Crossing, it is unclear. In the affidavits, they note that the percentage of interstate use factor of 32% was not applied. We acknowledge now that that is in their tariff filed in 2002. Though my client would dispute the legal merit of placing your interstate PIU in your tariff. Telling most of all, I think, for this commission, and maybe this is outside, as Mr. Smith would point out, the issue before the commission today, the billings themselves, as admitted in the reply, did not change. They simply changed the amount that was attributable to inter versus intrastate switch access. So, I mean, you're left with a obvious conclusion that the rate that was being charged for inter and intrastate was the same. If the minutes didn't change, only the allocation between the rate that is subject to review by this commission versus the rate that is not subject to review by this commission changed, being left with the same amount, the only conclusion is that they are attempting to charge Global Crossing the quest rate, in effect, 6.8 cents for inter and intra. We have, of course, neglected or refused to pay that on an interstate basis. So this matter comes about. We did receive, in an affidavit filed by counsel for Orbitcom, cover sheets, and our billing administrator at Orbitcom admitted in his SIR reply affidavit that he had received those sheets, where there is a bevy of credits and debits without further explanation between inter and intra-LATA charges. What those mean or where they came about, I don't know. I suppose that it will be argued that that is the adjustment that the Martin Group did in September after it was discovered in June, prior to the dismissal in July. Most telling, and I think this is pertinent in a motion to dismiss. The exhibit that was attached to the original petition, when you look at the affidavit submitted by counsel, lays out that there are 19 unbundled billings listed in the original complaint. Sorry for my chicken scratch as I hold that up. Two of those billings are for South Dakota. The other 17 billings, as detailed in the information provided by counsel, are from states such as Colorado, Iowa, Minnesota, New Mexico, and Montana. South Dakota, in fact, under Exhibit A, which was submitted, represents only 39.64% of the total amount of $283,000 claimed as owing by Orbitcom. Now, the standard, of course, for a motion to dismiss is to challenge the legal sufficiency of a claim. There is nothing in the original petition as it relates to the misbillings or mistakes in billing of Orbitcom. That arises only after we submit affidavits, which I would argue are properly submitted in a motion to dismiss setting when meant to describe the exhibits or further expand upon the limited nature of the exhibits that were submitted by Orbitcom. In fact, Orbitcom doesn't dispute that the billing records that were submitted with the affidavit of Sean Herrick for Global Crossing, who's in charge of Switch Access Services, accurately represents the billings that were, in fact, transmitted to my client. Now, the standard, as correctly identified by Mr. Smith earlier, was that matters that are outside fall, if there's outside evidence introduced, certainly you fall to a summary judgment motion. Now, I agree with Mr. Smith's summarization, but in this case, I think that the commission is within its purview to find that the information that was submitted to expand upon the exhibits, which are undisputed, does not create a factual issue. It merely goes to elaborate upon a very simple pleading which left out a lot of the information. The exhibit with the 19 codes, as you were, I mean, now after I found out through reading affidavits that, as an example, AID stands for Iowa, well, now I understand that, but that was not clear from the original submission. OED means Montana. Now, that is clear through the submission of that information. We've done nothing to submit outside evidence other than try to expand upon the information that I would say that is less than forthcoming for the commission. If the commission were to consider this a motion for summary judgment based on the evidence submitted by the plaintiff in this action, then certainly I think that issue that Mr. Smith addressed as to notice would be waived. Although I'm perfectly fine teeing this up as a motion to dismiss based on the information that's been uncovered from the exhibit itself, but under a summary judgment motion, we would certainly pass muster as well. I think that the commission is left at least with the option, at a minimum, of dismissing this as it relates to the matters that are clearly not within its jurisdiction. There clearly cannot be a claim for relief for recovery of amounts that were not incurred within the jurisdiction of the state of South Dakota. So to request that through a exhibit that isn't forthcoming is a mistake. I think this matter needs to be dismissed. My client would be willing, in the interest of fairness, to suggest that a dismissal without prejudice as it relates to the South Dakota claims would be warranted, although I think it's perfectly within the purview of this commission and its authority to dismiss something that is clearly so legally unmeritorious, so as, I don't mean to say punish, but a principle of fair pleading requires that we be on notice as to what the claims actually resolve around, and I think the bevy of information that was supported to further expand upon Exhibit A shows that Global Crossing continued to pay the amounts listed in those billings as intrastate charges, and only after we pointed that out to the commission. Did Orbitcom come forward and claim that there was this billing error with debits and credits hidden somewhere that would warrant an adjustment? If they want to plead that, they have to plead it. They can't come here now and argue it. With that, commissioners, I will step aside and allow testimony by Orbitcom, but we'll be available for rebuttal and any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Moore?
Thank you, Commission. Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of Orbitcom this morning, and I also have with me three gentlemen who are here on behalf of Orbitcom, the President, Vice President, and another representative seated in the back of the room if there are any particular specific questions which would need to be answered with regard to the billing. However, given the procedural posture that brings this matter before the Commission today, it is in fact a motion to dismiss, and the Commission discussed the applicable legal standards and procedural formalities involved in a motion to dismiss in an earlier docket today. And I would submit to you that the appropriate legal standard under which to judge the complaint that was presented to you in February of 2008 by Orbitcom is whether that complaint raises any legal claim or any valid claim for relief. What is required under the South Dakota Rules of Civil Procedure is notice pleading. And in this particular case, Global Crossing was put on notice that they had failed to pay certain invoices which had been sent to it. Now, I'm sure as you've been able to discern from the myriad pleadings that have been put before you to date in this particular matter, it has been a bit of an evolving argument, to say the least, and perhaps to a certain extent on behalf of both parties in attempts to better flesh this out. But under the Rules of Civil Procedure, notice pleading is the only requirement. And the complaint that was made indicated that Global Crossing had failed to pay all of the intrastate charges due and owing it for a particular period of time. That is clearly set out in the complaint that was filed in 2008. It's also interesting to note that, as an initial matter, the motion to dismiss essentially was twofold. It stated that the complaint was complete fabrication, and that this commission lacked any jurisdiction to take a look at the issues. Well, as acknowledged in both further pleadings and in oral argument today, Global Crossing has admitted to having actually received the invoices which were sent to Global Crossing in September of 2007. Now, rather than make a phone call or ask any questions to Orbitcom about those particular invoices, we arrived at this juncture here today where a complaint was filed and Global Crossing essentially made a motion to dismiss. There have been numerous facts put before this commission, both in the context of the affidavits as well as the arguments. And obviously there could be a conversion of this motion to summary judgment. However, I think that the facts that have been presented would certainly indicate to this commission that there are material disputes of fact as set forth in the billings, it's set forth in what happened, and is set forth in what Global Crossing has paid to date on its outstanding invoices and otherwise. And instead, really, the tactic that has been taken by Global Crossing is to somehow suggest that Orbitcom has either fabricated its complaint, it's operated in violation of federal law, it's engaged in such behavior as to implicate federal action as opposed to state action. And the fact of the matter is that the initial complaint alleged that there were intrastate amounts due and owing which had not been paid. Those were, in fact, related to a billing error which was legitimately discovered during the settlement of the first matter, and which, upon further edification and clarification with Martin Group, which is Orbitcom's third-party biller, it was discovered that the wrong factor was applied. Those invoices were redone, re-invoiced, and sent out in as timely manner as could be done in order to allow for a thorough investigation of those facts. There was no payment of those. This matter was then discovered. If Global Crossing's argument is now that they were not somehow put on notice, I find that a bit disingenuous. However, the remedy at this point would be to file an amended complaint if there would need to be further elucidation of the particular facts. However, I think, again, the original complaint does that, and we couldn't have done that at this juncture without seeking leave from this commission to file an amended complaint because there have, in fact, been responsive pleadings filed. So I think under either standard in this particular case, if you look at the motion to dismiss or even the motion to summary judgment, which I would indicate isn't really before this commission today and can't be without the appropriate procedural steps being taken under the law, Orbitcom has presented a valid claim for relief under its initial complaint, and this matter certainly is deserving of further opportunity for discovery and hearing in order to properly flesh out the issues, in order to determine what amounts are definitively due and owing to Global Crossing, and what should be done in the future. So under the applicable legal standard of a motion to dismiss, granting the motion to dismiss would be inappropriate and premature. And with regard to the motion for summary judgment, if Global Crossing believes that it can substantiate its claims that certain of the amounts that have been claimed by Orbitcom are in fact only interstate, it certainly has the right to flesh that out through discovery and bring an appropriate motion at a later point in time. However, that too is premature given the fact that we've really had only conclusory statements made to date and a bit of an evolving argument at all stages. So I would respectfully request that this commission deny the motion to dismiss and allow this complaint to proceed on its merits and for further discovery in order to better define the issues. And if it does become appropriate at that point in time, Orbitcom could seek leave to amend its complaint in order to properly define those issues. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Staff? Comments?
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. I do agree that there were a variety of questionable factual issues put forward by both parties. And I do also agree that Global Crossing was put on notice that there are some potential billing errors. And I think these factual issues would be best fleshed out through discovery so all parties can better understand those facts and the arguments. And staff would recommend that the motion be denied today and we further explore the factual issues.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Van Camp, would you like a minute to rebut?
Thank you, Commissioner. My question, I guess, would resolve around how many bites of the apple does Orbitcom get here? Not to seem disingenuous, but the complaint was filed with the exhibit that I've spoke about at length. We have the billing records. They've been submitted. The issue is the September debit and credit, which comes with no explanation. The billing records tied out. We have paid according to the information we submitted, which ties in for the motion to dismiss purposes to the Exhibit A of the original complaint, all the amounts that were due on intrastate. Coincidentally, I mean, I think the commission is perfectly within its purview to recall as a body that in 07-79, after we paid the amounts of interstate due in that matter, we find ourselves with a number that is exactly what was remaining in dispute at that point for interstate. So I'm willing to admit that the concept of constantly evolving arguments can create factual disputes, but as it was cited in the brief, 11th hour affidavits after the original pleading cannot create issues sufficient to warrant continuing of a matter such as this. Were that the case, of course, any plaintiff could certainly continue to push the argument forward. With that all being said, certainly I think at the minimum this commission needs to dismiss the matters that have been clearly demonstrated to be outside the jurisdictional bounds of this commission. The own materials that have been filed by Orbitcom show that they are seeking recovery of 40% of the claimed amount for services that were provided outside of the state of South Dakota. That is certainly not a matter that can be brought before this commission. And at a minimum, that needs to be dismissed, and how the rest of this is handled by the commission is certainly within its purview, but we've stated our position. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Moore.
Thank you. I'll be brief. With regard to Mr. Van Camp's request for relief, I would propose to this commission that that's also premature at this particular time. And the point of a motion to dismiss is to discuss the pleading itself. And so, therefore, while we certainly could have submitted more affidavits and additional information, I didn't believe that would be particularly beneficial. And what it really does is send everyone down a rabbit hole to a certain extent as far as what particular facts are true, what particular facts are correct. And that's what's better disposed of through discovery and with a motion to dismiss, so that you can properly lay out undisputed material facts, so those can be rebutted, so there can be appropriate citations to the record that are actually substantiated and founded not only by one party, but have been reviewed by the commission and by all parties, and have had the and everyone has had the opportunity to fully explore those. So I would, again, urge the commission to simply deny the motion to dismiss and to allow the parties to proceed with discovery in this matter. And if it becomes clear at a later point in time that there are certain issues that need to be brought to the commission's attention, I have no doubt that the parties are certainly capable of doing that or even perhaps agreeing on those. Thank you.
Question for Ms. Sumler. Did staff have an opinion on the partial dismissal that raised by Mr. Van Camp?
I do. I think, again, all those issues deserve further exploration, and I wouldn't recommend dismissal at this point. Without discovery, it's hard to understand all of those facts. I would not recommend dismissal. I would not recommend dismissal.
All right. And I myself have some questions about the PIU and other issues. In this case, I agree that I think dismissal is the proper way to go about this and let the facts actually pan themselves out. So I'll motion in TC08-005 that the commission dismiss the complaint or deny the dismissal. Discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Quebec votes aye also. In the next docket, we have TC08-040 in the matter of filing approval of the interconnection agreement between Quest Corporation and Access Point. On April 16, 2008, the Commission received a filing for the approval of interconnection agreement between Quest Corporation and Access Point. Today, shall the Commission approve the amendment to the agreement? Moving party is Quest, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, we have no comments.
What's that?
We have no comments.
No comments, okay. And is there anyone here from Access Point? All right, we'll move to staff.
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. The agreement was properly filed and executed. It does not appear to contain any discriminatory language. No comments were filed, and staff recommends approval.
All right. Commissioner, questions? Hearing none on TC08-040, I'll motion that we approve the amendment to the agreement. Discussion? None. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Quebec votes aye also. Okay. Number five is the USF. Why don't we take the last two things on our docket, and then we'll come back to all the USF filings. So we'll move to item number six, TC08-065. In the matter of the complaint filed by MCI Communications Services, doing business as Verizon Business Services, against Capital Telephone Company, Incorporated, regarding traffic pumping. On June 12, 2008, Quest Communications Corporation filed a petition to intervene, and today shall the commission grant intervention to Quest. Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner. We filed for intervention in this docket, and the respondent has sought to oppose our intervention. I would observe several things. First of all, Quest Communications Corporation is Quest's long-distance arm, our affiliate, and as such is similarly situated to Verizon that brought the complaint in the first place. We terminate traffic, long-distance traffic, to small LECs all over the country, Capital being one of them. We pay Capital terminating switch access charges. Therefore, we have a direct and specific pecuniary interest in this docket. And I can say on information and belief, although because we haven't been granted leave to intervene, we haven't conducted any discovery, that we suspect that Capital makes most, if not all, of its revenue from the practice of traffic pumping, which has been described very well in Verizon's complaint. And we believe that because we're similarly situated, we're entitled to intervention under the Commission's rules at 2010-01-15 at SEEK. And with that, we have nothing further. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Anyone from Capital Telephone, Mr. Parsons?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jonathan Canis and Catherine Marshall are outside counsel, but I'm local counsel for Capital. Just a few comments. So the complaint that Verizon filed against Capital Telephone Company addresses an issue that's almost entirely an interstate matter. I think the total billings at issue in this very small dispute in South Dakota amount to just a little over $500, or an average of about $50 per month. Right now, the dispute between Verizon and Capital Telephone Company, which is almost 99% interstate, is being negotiated in a settlement that's being overseen and assisted with by the FCC. And the practice that's alleged to be a scam and unreasonable by Verizon and Quest is a practice that's complaints about that have been rejected repeatedly by the FCC, but this is something that's covered by the Federal Communications Act and has been repeatedly held not to violate it. Under the standard, under SDCL 126-17.1, Quest has to do more than just say, well, we agree with the allegations made by Verizon, and maybe we would be hurt too. They have to show a direct pecuniary interest, and in this really de minimis dispute that is essentially a federal matter, there's really no reason to, or at least Quest has not made a showing that they should be allowed to piggyback onto Verizon's claims here, merely stating that they agree with Verizon's position and that they might be able to make the same claim is not enough under this under the statutory standard. So we request that the petition for intervention be denied.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Staff?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. The complaint that has been filed here is company specific. Quest can and should file its own complaint against Capital, as the facts would be different in each case. In any decision by the Commission in this matter, in 065, would not impair or impede Quest's ability to prosecute a claim against Capital. Quest will not lose any of its claims if it is not allowed to intervene in this matter, nor will it be prejudiced if it's not allowed to intervene. Should Quest file its own complaint in the near future here, and if these two dockets were to remain on the same time frame, what we could do is we could combine the dockets for purposes of the hearing only. And then that way, it would benefit Capital in that they would only have to bring their witnesses to South Dakota once. We could conduct the hearing, hear from both parties, but Quest would have to file its own complaint here. And I think we've done that in the past where we've combined dockets for hearing purposes. But they would remain on their own tracks. So, staff would recommend that the request for intervention be denied. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, with regard to the counsel for Capital's comments, I just observed that what he might consider de minimis in terms of revenue or monies owed or not owed pale in comparison to some of the policy questions, fundamental policy questions here, which go to specific application of local exchange tariffs in South Dakota, something that's directly under your jurisdiction. I would respond to Ms. Kramer by saying that granting Quest intervention in the procedure will simply streamline this. We can combine the cases for hearing, that's true, but Quest would be perfectly willing to file pleadings if granted intervention in this matter to explain specifically what our interests are and how, if any facts diverge from Verizon's pleading. But from a policy standpoint, the cases are going to be fairly identical. I mean, we would have the same objections to the practices that Capital makes that Verizon does. And obviously, we would conduct discovery and then submit pleadings based on that discovery, which would be fact-specific to Quest. But I think we save everyone's time and the resources of the commission and staff by granting intervention here and just running these cases on parallel track.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons, anything further?
Nothing further, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Colbeck, yes. If I may. This is Karen Kramer. I spoke to Mr. Gerdes this morning, and he is not able to be here. He represents Verizon, nor is their out-of-state counsel able to be on the phone today. And he just wanted me to tell you that Verizon has no objection to the Quest intervention.
Thank you. Commissioner, questions?
Ms. Kramer, sort of, you know, help me understand part of this. I mean, is it possible that at the conclusion of a proceeding like this that the commission could order some relief to anyone who may have been disadvantaged by business practices of Capital, even if they weren't a party to the case?
Well, of course, you can do anything you want. Would it be defendable? I think your better practice is in these matters to have a specific complaint in front of you and a specific company with specific facts. Part of my issue with Quest intervening here is, say Capital is perfectly happy and Verizon with the outcome of this matter, but Quest doesn't like it. Well, then Quest can appeal it and drag everybody on through the process. They really should have their own docket. And again, the difference with, I believe, with, well, and it's, it, it's true with administrative law is everything is fact specific and case specific, and what may be public interest in one matter may not necessarily be the same public interest in another. And of course, we do have case law that says that you know, we are different than a court, and there is no stare decisis. There is no, you know, precedent in the sense. I mean, you can do the same thing, but you don't have to. And so that's where I always prefer that there not be an intervention in complaints.
Well, and I understand, at least I think I understand the case law, but from a practical standpoint, I mean, the precedence does have commission. I mean, if it sort of, I mean, the commission does have precedence. I mean, if it changes its mind in an arbitrary or a capricious way, then that's a problem legally as well.
Right. That's different, though, than finding a different decision based on the facts in front of you.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, if I might, I might just look to Commission Counsel to see if they have any insight.
Absolutely.
I guess it's, to me, I guess I might, although I agree that there is some precedent out there that talks about court precedent that talks about commission decisions not being binding on subsequent commissions and all that. To me, those decisions have related more to those things that are more regulatory in nature as opposed to what I think this is, which is really more adjudicatory in nature. And to me, I guess I've got to kind of go with Mr. Thompson on this one in that I think this particular case raises issues that go beyond whether, you know, and again, we're talking facts here that we don't have, but as to what a precise dollar amount might be, I don't think that's really what's at stake here. And, you know, we've exercised liberality in interventions on cases that involve significant I guess I would say precedent-setting decisions like this. I think those kinds of issues are in this case. To me, albeit it's not precisely within Verizon's particular request for relief, but clearly to me, Quest has a pecuniary interest in the kinds of practices that are complained of, and I guess I would err on the side of granting intervention. And let me ask you this, would it be Quest's intention if you're granted intervention then to file something along the lines of like a complaint in intervention or something like that that would put you in a similar posture to Verizon, or what would be your thought in terms of procedure if you would
go along? Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Johnson, Mr. Smith, I think I agree with you. I believe that Quest would have to set out in a pleading once we've had the opportunity to conduct discovery what our precise complaints are, and obviously we'd have to go through the process of allowing capital to respond to that. But yes, the answer to your question is we would envision looking at something along the lines of the pleading that Verizon filed in this case.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to that? This is Mr. Parsons.
Yes, Mr. Parsons.
I just wanted to underline something that Ms. Kramer said, that there's really no conceivable reason I can see for allowing Quest to intervene and then figure out what its complaint is going to be, rather than doing its own docket filing. The only procedural effect of that is, as Ms. Kramer pointed out, to allow Quest to become a fly in the ointment of what are ongoing FCC supervised negotiations to settle this matter between the complainant Verizon and Capital Telephone Company. And if Quest does have its own complaint and it wants to sit down and figure out what it is, then it should initiate its own filing rather than be someone who can interfere with this current filing that I've been authorized to represent is in a stage of negotiation towards settlement.
Thank you, Mr. Persons. Ms. Kramer.
And I was going to note that also, that as Mr. Thompson pointed out, after they conduct discovery, they will file a pleading. Well, we all know how long discovery takes. So now you're holding up this matter while waiting for them to really do exactly what staff is recommending, which is file their own complaint, have their own docket. And as Mr. Parson points out, if this thing settles between Capital and Verizon, well, you know, then we're stuck out there, yet we have to go forward because Quest is still in the matter. So I just, it's just cleaner and easier for all parties, I believe, to have separate complaints here. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Johnson? Mr. Johnson? I've got one if you want me. Yes, Mr. Parsons, you state that you're dealing with the FCC and coming to an agreement with Verizon. Do I understand that correctly?
Well, I don't want to overstate. The answer to the petition for intervention describes that there are currently negotiations between Verizon and my client, Capital, in which FCC staff is participating. They're supervising the negotiation of a settlement. There has not been a settlement.
Okay. I, too, like to err on the side of granting, but how could you give me maybe a little bit of a timeline of how far along those negotiations are?
That, I apologize. I don't have further information on that. I could get that.
Okay.
I don't think there is a timeline.
All right. Do you think that a solution is imminent?
I don't have that information. All I know is that there are negotiations and that the FCC is involved in those negotiations. So I don't want to misrepresent. I don't think the PUC should conclude that a settlement is imminent, because I don't have that information, and that may not be the case.
All right. Thank you.
Commissioner Colbeck, what I can tell you, and again, I don't want to overstate it by any means, but what Mr. Gertis told me yesterday is he had anticipated getting to me yesterday with word on the settlement. And then it didn't come in yesterday, and so they were thinking today. But whether that's a thumbs up or thumbs down on the settlement, I can't tell you. But, you know, we were kind of waiting on that yesterday. But, again, not to overstate what that's. I don't know what the settlement is or any part of it.
Thank you. Mr. Smith?
Well, I guess one thing is, you know, the federal case is the federal case. That isn't what this is. I guess we, without having any concept of what those settlement negotiations might involve, you know, to the extent to which they're going to maybe resolve, what I think, as Mr. Thompson has correctly pointed out, are some issues that go beyond, you know, the minutiae of a few bucks, you know, that may or may not be at issue in the complaint. And if I recall, I forgot to say, I thought I had it here with me in my file, but I don't have the complaint. But my recollection is that the complaint requests relief that much of it is not at all Verizon-specific. And to me, with respect to those bigger issues that are presented in that complaint, I mean, that's a very philosophical complaint. It goes to the heart of a lot of what the access regime is all about, and to me those are big questions, and I guess my attitude is Quest is still our largest phone company in the state, and I guess it's hard for me to see why they wouldn't have a dog in that fight, but again, that's just me, and I certainly think Ms. Kramer's opinion is entitled to as much deference as mine and the other attorneys who have spoken here today.
Mr. Chairman, a question for either Mr. Smith or Mr. Thompson. I mean, why wouldn't the more appropriate way to get at some of the policy and discussions you're talking about, Mr. Smith, be to have Quest file its own complaint and then proceed as Ms. Kramer described?
I guess I really don't have a big objection. I guess just based on Mr. Thompson's outline of what, you know, his intentions were here today, it's just simpler, they can get in here, but if that's the preferred outcome, that's not an unreasonable procedure either, unless Mr. Thompson, you have some reasons for thinking that that's not an acceptable outcome.
Mr. Smith, is just a less preferable outcome for the company. Obviously, we're going to pursue this. I mean, we're involved in litigation regarding traffic pumping before the FCC in federal district court here in South Dakota, in Iowa, in Minnesota, before the Iowa Utilities Board, and now at the PUC. So these issues, which Mr. Smith has exactly right, they are large policy issues that affect our company deeply and adversely. And we would ask for similar types of relief that Verizon has pled for, not just with regard to some revenues, but with regard to the practices themselves, the interpretation of state tariffs, what constitutes a customer and an end user, what constitutes a legitimate access charge versus regulatory arbitrage that ought to be illegal. All of these policy questions have entered into these cases. And I would say that if you combine the cases for hearing, as was suggested, then you're going to have to wait for Quest discovery anyway. You know, the timeline remains the same if these cases are consolidated for hearing. So we just prefer to get in the case now, start our intervention now, and not delay by going through the process of filing a complaint, opening a separate docket, and creating a second set of, a second work process, simply because Capital may believe that they're attempting to settle this complaint. I mean, I've spoken to the Verizon counsel as well, who told me that he doesn't believe settlement's imminent. So it could happen. It might not happen. But we think the best way to get into the case and the quickest way to get into the case so as not to delay these issues any further than necessary is for Quest to intervene as opposed to putting this on a separate docket.
Yeah, maybe I might have opened up a can of worms with the complaint and intervention question, which might not have been a prudent thing to do here. Let me ask you this. If you don't make any kind of request, as I recall, the request for relief, the only monetary request for relief of Verizon was a request that a credit be issued with respect to any intrastate damages found to have occurred here. If Quest doesn't go down that road and you strictly are piggybacking and want to be involved on the policy decision-making end, then there will, in fact, be no new issues put forth by Quest. You're basically just in here to defend Quest's interest on the I guess we call them the legal and the policy issues that are novel and clearly raised for all companies. I'm actually really surprised that Quest is the only intervention petition we've got in this thing. I really am. But I don't know, do you have an observation on that?
I guess I would say that we certainly would ask for a relief in the form of credits for whatever switched access fees that we've paid to Capital that the commission would determine were unjust, improper, unreasonable. Having said that, I mean, I do believe that the policy issues bulk larger in this case. And as I said, this is one case of a number that we're pursuing across the nation.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Ms. Kramer.
I just wanted to clarify that when I had suggested consolidating the hearings, I thought Quest was further down the road than they are. It wasn't until Mr. Thompson said they would have to conduct discovery that I realized that they really are at the beginning and not the middle. And so in order to keep this one on track, it probably would not be possible to consolidate the two matters because Quest really is, it sounds like, just beginning in South Dakota.
So does that change your opinion?
No, I still think they should. That, if anything, reinforces my belief that they are just going to, you know, by allowing them in, if they're really just starting, they could be prejudicing the rights of the others, and they suffer no prejudice themselves by being denied intervention.
Well, I would respond, Mr. Chairman, by saying that we're not naive with regard to what we believe we'll discover when we begin this. We would also subpoena the discovery that's been propounded by Verizon and determine thereby, for whatever answers Capital has supplied or is about to supply or will supply sometime in the future. Those answers would be available to us as well through legal process. I don't want to give the impression that we're starting the first step of a 1,000-mile journey. I mean, we are far down the road, that we have voluminous discovery in the Iowa board case. It sits on my bookshelf, and it constitutes about 19 linear feet of notebooks. And I would tell you that it won't be difficult for us to propound discovery. We do that rather quickly. And as the commission is aware, in the SanCom case, which is before this commission as well, we've propounded discovery, and it would probably look something, if not exactly like that.
All right. Thank you. Well, Mr. Smith.
I just one other observation. I mean, in talking about delay and all of that, I mean, we're talking here. The complaint was filed by Verizon on May 28th. I mean, the filing date was, in terms of legal counting, was 23 days ago. And I'm looking here without my glasses. Quest filed its motion to intervene on June 12th, which is, by my reckoning, approximately 2 weeks after that. I guess, you know, to me, for what I think is a pretty major case, I just don't see it that way. But, again, that's just my opinion. It looks like Quest has acted diligently. There's no delay going on here. And again, I just don't see how you can circumvent the fact that Quest has a dog in the fight of the resolution of the major questions that this case raises. And as far as the other things go, in terms of what Quest may file later, what may happen, I think we can cross those bridges when we come to them. You know.
I don't have anything further, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Persons.
Just two more observations. Under the rules of civil procedure, typically, whether you're in state or federal court, you know, a complaint in intervention has to be attached to your petition for intervention. And here it seems we're at a place where what will or will not be alleged by Quest is uncertain. So I would think that advises against granting the motion for intervention. And I just also wanted to reinforce, you know, I know that Quest would like to import its philosophical agenda into this case, but this case does not necessarily have to involve those policy questions and may well be settled as a billing dispute or as a global resolution between these two parties over what is really, it could be, just a limited amount of money that's involved in South Dakota. I think Quest's presence will hinder that possibility and therefore raise the possibility that we'll be consuming judicial or commission resources we don't necessarily need to consume.
Can I ask you one thing, Mr. Parsons? This is John Smith, commission counsel here.
Certainly.
I'm just trying to recall, and I regret that I didn't look or digging into this much. Usually intervention is a lot more routine than this in these cases here, but I'm trying to remember the Citibank case and what that holds with respect to the ability of an intervener to perpetuate a case when the original parties have settled. And I'm just, my memory says that the Citibank case holds that an intervener cannot perpetuate a case beyond that point. And can you remember that? I can't remember it. And what I might do is recommend to the commission that they defer this so we can check on a few of these things, but
I don't. I'm not familiar with the specifics of that case, but at least the complaint and intervention could not be resolved between Verizon and Capital. But no, I'm not familiar with the facts of that case.
Mr. Chairman, I'd point to Rule 2010-01-15.05, and specifically to the last full paragraph of your rule, and which says, and I'm paraphrasing now, that a party granted leave to intervene, or a person granted leave to intervene, becomes a party to the case and enjoys all rights and privileges as a party to the case. So I would submit that your rules make it fairly clear that, as you say, Quest has a dog in the fight, and that your rule, at least, would provide a basis for this case to go forward if other parties settle out. And, you know, that's routine in litigation. Parties settle out, case continues.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Any commissioner questions? Okay. I need a second here.
Are you looking for commission action, or?
Well, yeah. I'm thinking. You go ahead if you want to make an action.
I would, Mr. Chairman, I would move that the commission deny intervention to Quest in this matter, and I have some comments, but I'll let the motion stand for now. Comments whenever you're ready for them.
And I can make a substitute motion to defer the action to the next commission meeting.
I guess I don't remember if an action to defer is debatable. I think it is. In any case, if it's not, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for leave to ask a question as to your purpose for requesting deferral.
Well, I I usually err on the side of granting intervention. I do have some concerns and some other merits on a settlement that is in the works, and no one could actually give me a defined answer if that was supposed to come yesterday or today. I would imagine if that was settled, that would change my opinion on whether they should have intervention or not.
Well, and I would just state, my personal belief has always been to provide incredible deference to those commissioners who want time to do additional legal research before coming to a decision. In this instance, though, I just think whether or not there's a settlement coming doesn't make a lot of difference, to me anyway, from a practical standpoint. I guess a motion can't carry if it doesn't have a majority vote, so we're probably going to end up deferring anyway. I mean, if we can't,
well,
to defer fails and then my motion to deny fails, you're probably going to get what you want anyway, so maybe I shouldn't pitch a fit about it.
No, and I'm just, I very much agree with counsel that Quest may have a dog in this fight, but if the fight is over, it's kind of, it would be kind of a moot point. I guess, Mr. Smith, where exactly are we at right now as far as judicial?
Well, I think where you're at is you've got two motions that have been made, and neither of them has received a majority of the commission. So,
well, we don't know that yet.
Yeah,
you don't know that yet. So, why don't you proceed to vote? You've got a substitute motion to defer. Vote on that first, and then you can vote.
And
on
we're back to the original.
If that fails, you back to the original motion.
Motion to defer, Mr. Johnson.
No.
Mr. Kovac is aye, so that motion will fail.
And I do, again, want to make clear that normally I would say yes. If we were going to do some legal research on the Citibank case or something that was important, then it would have been an aye. But sure. To me, either somebody's got a right to intervene or not, really, regardless of whether or not there is possible settlement in another level pending. So
now we're back to the first case, and you vote to... I just want to clarify your motion. Your motion is to
deny intervention to Quest. By way of conversation, it's not that I don't believe that there are some issues that should be fleshed out on Quest's, from Quest's perspective, but clearly Quest, I think, is trying to answer some policy questions here, and perhaps that's more appropriately done under their own proceeding. Maybe that Verizon doesn't end up wanting to have those questions answered. And for me, that's why. I mean, let's go ahead and get Quest in, but let's do it on their own number, on their own docket. And if we can find some efficiencies down the road, then let's do so.
All right. Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Kovac votes aye also. So intervention is denied.
It's a lot more difficult doing work with only two of us, isn't it?
I wish Gary was here. No. That's fine. I just wanted to... I usually like to err on the side of intervention, but in this, I think it's a little different. I think it's kind of a little bit of a special case, so... We will move on. PC08-089. In the matter of the application for ClaireTech.com, Incorporated, for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange services to South Dakota. On June 18, 2008, South Dakota Telecommunications Association, SDTA, filed a petition to intervene. Today, shall the commission grant intervention to SDTA or any other parties who file within the intervention date?
Good morning. Margo Northrup on behalf of SDTA. Rich Coit could not be here today, so I am here on his behalf, respectfully requesting that you grant SDTA's intervention in this petition. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone from ClaireTech wish to comment? If not, we'll go to staff.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. Based on the filing, staff would recommend granting SDTA intervention in this matter.
All right. Commission questions? Hearing none on TC08-089, I'll motion that the commission grant intervention to SDTA. Commission discussion? Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Kovac votes aye also. All right. Now we are back to... We have 18 more dockets, which is number 5. In the matter of the request for certification regarding the Universal Service for use of Federal Universal Service support in dockets TC08 45, 08 46, 08 47, 08 48, 08 49, 08 50, 08 51, 08 52, 08 53, 08 54, 08 55, 08 56, 08 57, 08 58, 08 59, 08 60, 08 61, and TC 08 62. Commissioner Johnson, it was kind of my guess that could we group them in lumps of six? Would that be? There's 18. We'll do three groups of six.
Well, perhaps suggestion might be let's look to staff, commissioners, advisors, and council, and just see if there are any particular docket numbers that they'd want to pull out. Then we'd know which to pull out.
Sure. Ned?
I don't have questions on any of them. This is Rolling Weast.
Okay. Margo?
Good morning. This is Margo Northrup again on behalf of SDTA, and I'm also have filed on behalf of a portion of these clients. We would just request that you provide certification to the FCC and the USAC as requested in each one of these petitions. I think these are not all of them that have been filed, but these are the portion that's been working with staff and has answered their questions and are ready for approval.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, should we take them all as a group then?
And he may have said that, but Mr. Best and Ms. Baker, you didn't have any particular concerns about any of them?
The individual companies have filed that they will use the funds in the appropriate manner, and they did respond to staff questions if we did have questions. We did not submit questions to every company. Some of them gave a more detailed explanation of how they fulfilled their construction plans that they were hoping for in 2006. Others did not give as much detail, so I asked further questions on what happened. If they didn't meet it, what happened to not meet it? But these 18 have responded, and staff would recommend that the commission send a letter of certification to the Federal Communications Commission and to the Universal Service Administration Company stating that these companies should get their be certified to draw funds in 2008.
Okay. All right, thank you. Ms. Baker, any comments? Okay. Are you sure? All right. I guess Commissioner questions. No questions. I know that the staff has done due diligence on this, and I've read a lot of the petitions. I know there was two and three rounds of questions that companies had to answer on some of them. I'm very happy that the amount of money that this motion represents is spent in South Dakota to provide for better telecommunications. So I will motion in all of the dockets previously mentioned, TC08045 to TC08062, that the commission, I'll read the question here, that the commission provide a certificate to the Federal Communications Commission and the Universal Service Administration Company regarding the plan for the use of Federal Universal Service support as proposed in each of the above dockets. Commissioner, discussion.
Well, I certainly think the motion is an appropriate one, Commissioner. And, you know, one thing that stands out every year is the level of investment that's going into, and most of it's marked proprietary exactly where the investment's going. But I think it's impressive the number of, the amount of fiber that's being laid to the premises. And, I mean, I guess we could probably take I know Mr. Best and other staff members have done incredible due diligence on these. We could probably ask a lot of questions, but frankly, when the spending is generally two or three times in the rural networks what they're receiving from the USF, even if we knock off a few hundred thousand here and there, It generally wouldn't change what I think the commission's ultimate determination would be. So I would tell you that having Mr. Bauer here in the audience does make me want to provide, ask him a lot of tough questions about Kennebec's filing, but it appeared to be certainly in order to my eyes. So
yes.
I would agree with your motion, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. And a lot of those dockets actually address fiber to the pram and fiber to the home, and that's one great thing that's coming to South Dakota in mad fashion. So very enthused about that. So,
and one more comment. I do think it is impressive to see companies that are putting so much more into their rural networks than they're required to. And I guess it's maybe up to a question of what they're required to, but certainly far more than what they're receiving in USF funding. Although that's the case with all of these 18, it's not the case, I think, with everyone who's received ETC designation in the state. And so these certainly deserve compliments for not making us call balls and strikes too closely.
Absolutely, and I would 100% agree with you that your universal service fund money should not be your company's budget for that year or anywhere close. Any more comments? All right. Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck votes aye also. Those dockets are passed. I believe that brings us to the end of our agenda. Unless I've missed anything, it's a rather lengthy agenda. Our next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held July 8th, 2008 at 9:30 in the Floyd Matthews Training Center. Please note that. Commission meetings are scheduled for July 29th and August 12th. The PUC commission offices will be closed on July 4th for 4th of July. And we will have grain warehouse rules will be held July 14th, 2008 at 10 a.m. in room 464, this room here. Is there any other business before the commission? Hearing none, we are adjourned. Thank you.